Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
Thank you.
WGN. I'm John Landecker at 7:36. Obviously, that song is called Nothing But a Good Time. And, you know, that'd be a great title for a book like Nothing But a Good Time, the Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. And Tom Bujor, do I have your name pronounced correctly?
Yes, Bujor.
Bujor. You're the writer. Bujor, and, what? Go ahead. Yes.
Yes. No, I am one of the two co-authors of the book.
And there's also illustrations, right? No.
They're about, they're about, well, they're about 20, 30 photos and then some cool sketches from costume designers and other cool stuff like that.
I have never seen a book about music laid out the way you have done it. When, you know, you hear people come out in the air, say, oh, you know, I have a book and, and getting this book ready, I talked to, musicians, managers, producers, engineers, label executive, publicists, stylists, costume designers, photographers, journalists, magazine publishers, video directors, club bookers, roadies, groupies, and hangers on. But not only did you talk to them, you use only their words, which I thought was incredible.
There were a couple precedents for it. There was a book by the band Motley Crue called The Dirt, where that was also turned into a Netflix movie.
Yeah,
where they used this format, and there've been a couple others. And we just using the voices of the people just seemed like a more compelling format for the book. You know, it's at the sort of best moments of the book. If you're a fan of one of these bands, you feel like you're, you know, sitting, you know, around a campfire with them and having them tell you the story in a way that we probably couldn't have done.
Yeah,
so it's a fun way to do a book.
I also got a big kick out of, let me make sure I get it here, the introduction. The foreword, rather, that Corey Taylor of Slipknot and Stone Sour wrote. Sure, in today's mindset, it was sexist, offensive, tasteless, Neanderthal, misogynistic, exploitive, aggressive, and based entirely in fantasy. But that was the point. I mean, that's the whole idea.
That, I mean, he pretty much encapsulates it. You know, he even though Slipknot, Corey Taylor's band, is, you know, sort of a much heavier affair and they wear these crazy masks, he, like both me and my co-author, Rich, really just grew up having this stuff, you know, beamed at us into our heads through MTV. And it was this fantastical, you know, it was this fantastical world where the bands were larger than life and there were pretty women in the videos and stuff. And, you know, by 2020, one standards, it was not, it wouldn't probably pass the political correctness litmus test, but, you know,
I don't think so.
This was a time where this was also, you know, it was a time where, you know, Caddyshack came out and the movie Porky's came out and every kid in America had the Farrah Fawcett poster or every boy at least, or a lot of them, the Farrah Fawcett poster on their wall. So, you know, it was definitely a different time, and it was definitely a music that was about, you know, sort of celebrating life and getting the most out of it and sort of the carefreeness of youth and all of that. So, It was, you know, something for maybe like a lot of, you know, for loner kids, the millions of them all across America, sort of this fantasy world that they could aspire to and sort of escape to.
Well, it's an explosion, and I mean it literally, of pyrotechnics, huge hair, spandex, guitars that were designed in a unusual fashion, at least for that time. I mean, it was a whole and loud, and it was just a whole approach to a whole different approach, rather, to rock music. And, you know, a lot of people who were in the business, I don't think they were ready for the success that this was going to bring during the 80s. I mean, you're talking the very higher echelon of performances and tours on the road. I mean, it was huge.
It was not. I don't think that the sort of gatekeepers were prepared for it. In fact, the band Van Halen had gotten a record deal and they were successful. But in the late 70s and early 80s, when this movement is starting out, you know, bands that played hard rock and had long hair were considered sort of relics and throwbacks to the 70s, to bands like Led Zeppelin and stuff. And actually, the record labels were much more interested in signing the new shiny thing, which was new wave bands like Elvis Costello and The Knack, who had the song My Sharona, and The Go-Go's. And so the hard rock bands were really in a state of disfavor until, you know, sort of in a very, very circuitous way and through a lot of lucky breaks, the band Quiet Riot puts out the song Come On, Feel the Noise. And that record knocks the Police out of the number one slot on the Billboard charts. And once that happens, you know, record labels are, when they see Blood in the Water, they go for it. So once that had happened, it just completely exploded. And, you know, it was a time, I mentioned before, but MTV was there. And these bands, because they were so visually oriented in all of the ways that you stated just before, they were perfectly suited for it. You know, the second you got them on TV, they would capture the imagination of these kids because they were, you know, they had so much color and personality and sort of fun and movement. And so they were tailor-made for this era.
It's 7:43, it's 7:20, excuse me, WGN. We're going to have more good times when we come back right after this.
Girl, you really got me now. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing. Girl, you really got me now. You got me so I get some bad nights.
Yeah, 720 WGN. I'm John Landegger at 7:47. The book is called Nothing But a Good Time, The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. And we're talking with one of the authors, Tom Bujor. And we, to go directly to what you were talking about, Tom, in the late 70s with record labels, I believe that is Van Halen's first release. And it's a cover.
That is. That's. I think that came out in 1977, and you know, that was a cover. I think it was the first single, and they were, you know, tremendously successful, and really the band that created the template for the whole decade in a lot of ways.
But I find that what you were talking about, in the sense that executives at record companies go with the flow, so to speak. And like to have as much, in quotation marks, guaranteed success as possible, which would lead me to believe that there was a discussion held between Van Halen and the record label as to what would be their first single, and that they took an old Kink song, and which was a proven hit already, maybe 10, 15 years before that, does not surprise me after hearing your explanation of how all that worked early on. It's my impression. Go ahead.
No, just there's an excellent autobiography by Van Halen's producer, Ted Templeman, and he was also their A&R person at the label, and he basically corroborates what you're saying, where he's basically, and it's almost true for any genre of band, that just, yes, you know, it's much easier to sell a song that's already been proven successful, especially right, if you've got, you know, a group that's untested and playing sort of this new hyper charged kind of music or something. At least there's one familiar thing to latch onto.
I've heard stories as this decade, the 80s, progresses. I find, from what I've read and heard, that the majority of this activity is generated in the Hollywood area, in the Troubadour and other rock and other bars or venues, rather, that played rock and roll. And you had people such as Guns N' Roses sort of roaming the streets, if you will, trying to establish a foothold. Am I correct about that?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, there were a couple bands from the East Coast, like Bon Jovi and Skid Row.
Right, right, right.
It was absolutely the Sunset Strip off, you know. And
yeah,
the thing about that is that even though L.A. is this enormous, sprawling city, the Sunset Strip and the area where this music was happening, it's really like 4 or 5 blocks.
Yeah, exactly.
And so
yeah,
it was the sort of the mecca. There were, you know, there were kids coming from all over the country to try and make it in music there.
Yep.
And on a Friday or Saturday night, you know, all the bands on the strip who were trying to get noticed would actually go to the copy store and make tens of thousands of they would make flyers. And they would, you know, they were just to try and get an edge, and they would hand them to anyone who was walking by. They would, you know, get in their cars with glue buckets and brushes and hit every single telephone pole that they could and dumpsters, and they would go over each other's stuff, you know, they're over each other's posters and
yeah,
get into fights and brawls about it.
Yes,
it was an incredibly concentrated and sort of dynamic scene, and all the people were switching bands back and forth because they all knew each other. And, you know, the stakes were high. If you made it, you would probably be a millionaire. So it was worth going for it, you know, completely, you know, as sort of gung-ho as possible. And, yeah, L.A. was the place,
yeah,
because there were all the bands, but the record labels are also on that strip. So
yes,
if your
right,
band has got a buzz, the A&R guy can just, you know, walk down and see you play after work, and you know he doesn't have to fly to wherever you might be from. So it was really the place to be seen and heard and to connect with other musicians.
Right, and
absolutely.
And there were just enough examples, Guns N' Roses, for instance, just enough examples of bands who were doing that. All of those things that you mentioned, running up and down the street, you know, printing their stickers, putting it on posters. There were just enough examples of bands that came out of that who were gigantic. I mean, there was a time when Guns N' Roses was just, there was no bigger musical act than in the States, as far as I was concerned. And they came directly from this.
They absolutely did. I mean, you know, Axl Rose and the rhythm guitar player Izzy Stradlin sort of emigrated from Indiana, but you know, a lot of the guys in Guns N' Roses, like Slash and the drummer, they actually went to Fairfax High School, so they didn't only,
right,
you know, sort of they were there. They grew up, you know, seeing the other bands, and they completely dominated the strip. And yeah, they, you know, they sold 6-8 million. Records. And so, you know, when that happens, there's going to, first of all, people are going to flock and try and imitate,
yeah,
them. So there'll be bands that sound like them, and the record labels are going to try and repeat the formula. And ultimately all of that spiral does not end well in any genre, but
no,
you know, it was, for a while, it's incredibly exciting and dynamic, and people are getting rich overnight,
or so it seems. Overnight success. They've been out there for a few years.
Exactly.
I was talking to, ironically, some people who were putting on a exhibit at the Abraham Lincoln Library in Springfield, Illinois. It's a salute to all the music that came out of Illinois and Chicago. And I was talking to some of the curators about a band that was here in the 80s called The Kind. And the thing was, and this has got to be true in L.A., these clubs were rock clubs. They don't have those anymore. I mean, you would go to a bar, there'd be a band. You'd go to another one, there's another band. You go to another one, there's another band. The next night, all the bands are there. You'd look at the wall, there'd be a list of everything, every band planned for the next 2 or 3 weeks. That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
I mean, there still are clubs, but I think that there was that it's not as rock centered.
Yeah.
I think that this was sort of this is a grand sort of moment for you know sort of hard rock and sort of straight up rock and roll, like, you know, where it was really dominating the thing. And there were, I mean, Enough's Enough is from Chicago. There were a great band from this this movement, you know. And it was probably the last time that sort of poppy rock music would dominate the charts and the culture, you know, there was this opportunity at that point because of MTV. There was sort of a monoculture. These were the bands that you saw when you turned on TV and sold 10 million copies and sold out the arenas. They really were the musical sort of experience for an entire generation.
Absolutely.
That kind of can't happen these days. People are too scattered.
Yep. And there's social media and all sorts of stuff. The book is called Nothing But a Good Time, The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. If you are even slightly interested in this era of music, you've got to get it, because everything in it comes right from the mouths of the people who were involved. It's very cool. Where do we buy the book? How do I get the book?
You can get it anywhere books are sold. So if you are if you like ordering from Amazon, it's there.
Yep.
If you want to go to support your local bookstore, they'll probably have it or be able to order it. Barnes & Noble, it is pretty much everywhere. And there's also an audio book version of it. And, of course, you know, you can get it on for your Kindle, et cetera.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, just in closing, I love some of the titles of your sections or chapters or whatever you want to call them. But I believe one of my favorites goes like this. I believe our bus got crabbed out. So on that note, thanks for being with us. It's been great talking
to you. Thank you so much for having me, and have a great evening.